Just in case, this is another edition of Pod Rocks. This is episode 14, and with me I've got Ben Stape. How you doing, Ben?
Good. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. Been a little bit since we got together, and we got some music news going to share with you. We've got some topics we'd love to go over and have you guys listen to these bad boys. You know, we're going to be adding some more social media aspects to the show. We're going to be trying some different things going down the road, so we're excited about that, but I think we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But right now, Ben, I think maybe we go over some music news, if I can talk right, tonight. What do you got?
Yeah, so actually a couple great things, in my opinion. We got some new albums that are coming out, which I always like new music. Disturbed has a new album coming out November 18th. Divisive, I heard a track off of it or a snippet of it, and you know, one thing you can count on from Disturbed is it sounds like Disturbed. So I'm interested to see kind of what they do, if there's something different or not to it. Queensryche also has another album coming out here on October 7th, so right around the corner, Digital Noise Alliance. I've also heard a couple of tracks off of it. It's definitely an interesting take. They have Mike Stone back in the band. We've kind of talked about him previously, but Parker being out, I think now he has been in the studio on this album, so it'll be interesting to see every single track and hear it. From what I've heard already, he's had a little bit of influence on it, especially the sound for the recording. So look for that one. Godsmack has another album coming out here very, very soon. They dropped a single on September 28th, so you can go out and check that one out. Their style, in my opinion, again, has changed a little bit. The last album definitely was a little bit more of a different direction than they've used to go, which is kind of cool when bands do that, but it still kind of sounds like them. Skid Row, they're writing new music. They've got a new single coming out, which I don't know if you're a fan yet or have been or should be, but check out Skid Row. I'm a fan of their earlier stuff for sure. Here's one for you, Justin. Steve Vai is touring. I don't know if you knew that or not, but he's apparently going to be going out and to the masses and getting people to show up, hopefully. And the other one I thought was, go ahead. What were you gonna say?
Oh, I said they will. He's got a dedicated fan base. He's established. He won't have an issue with that.
Yeah, I'm a fan of his too. Here's one I thought was really, really interesting. I hope this comes to fruition myself, because I think it would be an interesting collaboration. Dave Mustaine has openly stated he wants to write some new music with James Hetfield. So Megadeth and Metallica, the two front men coming together and writing something, I think would be kind of cool. As you know, Dave was in the band and then wasn't in the band, and their styles are definitely a lot different now than what they were back then. So I think it would be an very interesting collaboration if they actually were to do it. I don't know if it's actually going to happen or not. The other one I wanted to bring up was the Red Hot Chili Peppers have done a tribute song for Eddie Van Halen. I listened to it just the other day. The music is, you know, it's very reminiscent of Chili Peppers, with the solo in there. I definitely thought was, it sounded like Eddie Van Halen. They really did a good job kind of recreating his style within it. And it you could say it fit the song, and then I think some people would say, no, it doesn't really fit, you know, the type of music the Red Hot Chili Peppers does. But definitely worth at least a listen. Get your own opinion. But that's some of the new music that's out there, and some of the news I just kind of wanted to bring up.
Yeah, there's a lot of activity out there, especially with some of the acts that have been they're established, you know, and also in a different era, especially the probably the early 2000s, late night, like 99 through 2002, 2003. And, you know, Godsmack being one of those bands. And that's interesting that they're out and about. I think a lot of these guys got stir crazy because they couldn't really tour a whole lot. And now it's like, hey, we can go out and do stuff, you know. And so creatively, they've got the energy pent up where they want to go do something. So just goes to show. At home or sitting in a home studio is not nearly enough to wet your whistle if you're a creative person.
Yeah, absolutely not. So what do you think about the Dave Mustaine and James Hetfield? I wanted to kind of get your take on that.
Well, I mean, well, first of all, James Hetfield, he's been out and about doing a lot of different types of projects. Well, I wouldn't say projects, but just guest appearances on different styles of music that are a far cry from Master of Puppets and Kill 'Em All and all these early albums, you know, that was closer to the time to when him and Mustaine had the falling out. Yeah, I'm not a historian of Megadeth or Metallica for, you know, by any stretch, but from what I know, you know, it's they had a huge falling out, and then, you know, Dave Mustaine planning My Revenge and, you know, VH1 class or VH1 Behind the Music, you know, I remember all that stuff. And so I think they're much older now, and they're kind of like, I mean, they've had decades to bury the hatchet and maybe like, yeah, this will work. And plus, I think from a, just from a business perspective, it's going to sell a lot of downloads or at least gather a lot of interest from both camps. So it makes sense business-wise to do it. And I think it's like kind of like the George Lynch, Don Dokken thing. It's like, you know, we're older guys now, and let's just get past all that stuff. Let's just get back together and make something happen, and that I think that's what we see here.
So you okay, I don't know if you were more of a Metallica fan or more of a Megadeth fan. Really, but
and real, I mean, I'm not really a metal guy, like that kind of metal. I had I mean, I like Symphony of Destruction. I like I cherry picked. I mean, I wasn't like this guy that or thrash metal shirts or any of that stuff, or, you know, sat in his room, you know, just like headbanging to, like, you know, records in the old days or anything like that. I'm not old enough to do that anyway, but I wasn't like a diehard fan where it's like, yeah, metal, you know, I was never like that. I had a much broader scope of interests, but I liked, I didn't dislike what some of the stuff they did, but I wasn't a hardcore fan to shorten up that answer.
So for me, I didn't really kind of start getting into the Metallica stuff until middle school, beginning kind of a high school thing, and at the same time I was kind of introduced to Megadeth at the same time. And one thing I definitely distinctly liked about Megadeth was Mustaine's way of writing riffs. Not only did he use, you know, the normal power chords or chords, he really kind of stretched out and did a lot of riffs within each one of those. So it's not just a power chord. He's doing riffs for the actual verses, or he's doing riffs for the chorus along with it. Symphony of Destruction, like you're saying, like just the chorus of it, you can hear that in the playing of it, which I think is really cool. Is where I think Metallica for me was kind of more, they had riffs in between the power chords and, you know, the pedaling.
I liked more of what Megadeth was doing than Metallica, because Megadeth had his own thing. But I guess I was never really drawn to either group overall because I wasn't angry enough. So I've never thrived on anger. So people that are tend to be pent up and thrive on that stuff as a release are going to really like that music. But I really, that being said, I thought that Megadeth stuff had a little bit more sophistication to it, and you didn't really see a lot of copycat behavior with Megadeth. At least I didn't. With Metallica, it was like there's all these guys that were trying to, you know, play their stuff verbatim and sound like Kirk Hammett and all that stuff, and it's like it just, I don't know. It just, Megadeth had a little bit more sophistication to it. And I just didn't see widespread, like, people would have guys have some Megadeth stuff up, but it was like Metallica this, Metallica that. And especially when I was in high school and stuff, it was like, it just, they were always about Metallica for some reason. It's like Firebirds versus Camaros. The Firebirds had they didn't produce as many units, or they had a specialized, narrowed focus on the interest. But everybody had an IROC or something, right? So I think Metallica's kind of like a little bit more available, I think. And I think that Megadeth was more sophisticated as far as its catalog.
It wasn't as mainstream, that's for sure.
It wasn't. And see, that's what I liked about it, was that it was, I think Mustaine stayed focused on what his mission was with that music. He was very focused on whatever he was doing. And I think that Metallica was kind of started out kind of thrashy. They were you know, they're, you know, the whole Bay Area thing. But You know, the thing was that I just think that Dave Mustaine had a much more focused approach. There was certain objectives he wanted to meet in his music, and I think that it was more of a singularity as opposed to Metallica. It was like all the members involved, and you know what I mean? And, you know, plus they changed, like, when Cliff Burton, had that unfortunate accident, and it changed the members, I think, views on their what they were doing musically as well as their lives. And Megadeth didn't have that. So there's variables to both bands. They're totally different in my mind. They sound different. There's, you know, and I mean, plus, you know, Dave Mustaine had Marty Friedman. Oh, my gosh. Chris Poland. And, you know, all these great players, but they're all different. And I mean, Chris Poland was awesome. And but then you get like Marty Friedman, who's a stand up artist in his own right. I mean, I've got some of his solo stuff, and it's incredible. The guy's just amazing. I mean, he cut heads with Jason Becker. I mean, you can't beat a pedigree like that. I'm sorry.
No, that guy, I actually got to see Megadeth with Marty Friedman in it, and I've been a fan of Marty Friedman's music for a long, long time. Like you, I listen to his solo stuff as well, and I appreciate his talent and what he brings.
And there's musicianship that was brought to the table that Metallica just never had and never will. I appreciate what they've done, but from a more virtuosic standpoint, that's even a word. There's different ingredients there that I guess I gravitated towards, more precision playing, and it was, man, when you've jammed out with Jason Becker, it's gonna change you, you know. And it, man, we should talk more about that guy another episode, because. And Marty Friedman as well. Like, both of those guys deserve their own episode.
Yeah, I think what you're saying kind of touches the topic that we kind of wanted to cover tonight, was bands and their sound, right? And how members coming and going either change it for the better, change it for the worse, but it definitely changes things, right? And Megadeth's it's a really good one. Like you're saying, you know, Chris Poland at the beginning, and then they get Marty Friedman. For their album that had like Hangar 18 on it, right? You can just tell that the stylistically was different, but it was still Megadeth, because Mustaine was writing a lot of the main riffs. But the solos, like you're saying, even in contrast with Marty Friedman versus Kirk Hammett, I think Kirk, when he was taking lessons from Satriani, I think he branched out a little bit more than what he does now. I think he's more kind of the blues oriented soloing, where Marty Friedman and the people that, you know, were in Megadeth and are in Megadeth kind of cater more toward the, the Steve Vais or the, you know, like you're saying, that the other players that are a little bit more, you know, you could call it technical. But I guess the simplest way I could put it's like listening to classical music versus listening to not classical music and just straight rock music, right? They're different. Not that they're good or bad, but they're different, right? Sometimes I want to listen to classical music, and to me, it's really in depth. That's why I'm pulled toward, you know, progressive music a little bit more in the styles that I listen to. But I still have an appreciation for, you know, the heavier rock stuff that, you know, could be a little bit more straightforward and isn't as technically complex, I guess is another way to say it too. So Megadeth being one of those bands, and then you also brought up Metallica, Cliff Burton, I think, brought a level of technicality that they had in their music through Puppets. And then I think they carried a lot of that into Injustice for All. But then I think they also got pulled into the Bob Rock producing. And Bob Rock was definitely, in my opinion, one of the top tier rock band, engineers and studio guys, right? That he did Motley Crue, Bon Jovi, you know, the people that were more at the rock side of things, not necessarily the thrash metal or heavy metal scene. So I think that definitely had a change on the Black Album, and it toned it down a little bit, and it slowed it down in comparison to their earlier albums. So even them just losing a bass player obviously changed their style and changed the direction that they were going and what they were doing. So good or bad, there's a lot of different bands that, you know, we can bring up. We'll probably bring up tonight. You know, bands like AC/DC, you know, they changed lead singer, and then look what happened after they changed the lead singer, right? I mean, you know what you're getting when you're getting AC/DC, and they do what they do, and they produce what they do, but his voice is way different than the original singer, I think, for the better.
Also, the attitude that was there, because if you have a front man, that changes the whole formula. I mean, we see it in Van Halen. We see it in, you know, a lot of other bands that, I mean, AC/DC had this really tight, groove-oriented sound when Bon Scott was there. And then when Brian Johnson showed up, it was, and joined the band, it got more kind of a more of a bigger, more polished mainstream sound. And but also because it was the 80s versus the 70s. And I like both forms of the band for different reasons. I mean, they went through drummers as well. They had a change up. So, you know, especially when they did like the 91 live album. And I think they recorded that in Donington, England, but I'd have to go back and check on that. But I think Chris Slade was the drummer on that one. It wasn't the original drummer. And so it was like, even that was different. And so not only do you have a different singer, you got a different drummer and just different style of playing. And it just was huge. It was just a huge style change. And it, to me, you could definitely tell that, like, the 80s stuff with Brian Johnson, it was like, it still holds up pretty well. Like, if you, they use it in movies, like Shoot the Thrill. Look at Iron Man. They threw.
Yep.
And they did War Machine. You know, they did the song War Machine, and that fits in perfect with any of the Iron Man stuff. It's such a big sound that it fits in perfect with a big movie like Iron Man, this big cinematic universe. So, I mean, you can't get that stuff with the Bon Scott. It was a different time. But I love both. And that's just my opinion as far as... I mean, they still use, obviously, some Bon Scott stuff for films. But I'm just saying, Marvel Cinematic Universe pops into my mind because the music is so huge. It has a bigger dimension to it. So, yeah.
Yeah, Iron Maiden did the same thing. You know, they changed singers after one of their first albums. And... I go back and I listen to Killers and I, you know, Phantom of the Opera, songs like that stick out to me. And then they, you know, they bring in Bruce Dickinson and then, ooh, man, there you go. Now you've got, you know, album after album with Bruce Dickinson and they sound great. And then I thought the interesting thing was they brought in that third guitar player, Janet Gears, right? So they have three guitar players, and that wasn't something that, you know, a lot of bands did back then, right? It was, you know, one guitar player or two, and now they have three, and their music changed even at that point too, which I thought, man, that's really kind of cool, the level that they're bringing to the game with that. So,
especially when they did Wicker Man back in 2000, they had three guitarists that were on the recording, and it was really cool. And I saw them live at Darien Lake with Queensryche as second on the bill, and Rob Halford opened up with a solo group. He was the opener. And when I saw it, I mean, Iron Maiden just killed it. You know, it was huge stage. You know, they had a big Eddie there, and they had, you know, all three players, and Bruce Dickinson was there. It was like, yeah, so they, I mean, they had like Adrian Smith, and being able to see Adrian Smith and Dave Murray, and, you know, I mean, it's just in Yannick Gears is like all over the place. He was just jumping around and, like a teenager, you know, it was crazy. He even had this one segment where he had his guitar and he was like kind of duking it out with the big Eddie stand up. It was cool. And man, that was 20 years ago, but it was like, it was crazy good. And so, yeah, that was definitely something where they brought in another person, but it was like, it added to what they were doing. It didn't change. It just made it bigger, a bigger sound. And I always thought it was cool that Yannick Gears played a Strat too.
You know, yeah.
And Dave Murray, they were all kind of like Strat guys. But I know that I know Adrian Smith had a Jackson, I think, he used for a while. It's kind of like a super strat type thing, but that was really cool, especially when doing like the triple guitar attack, you know, and Steve Harris, of course, you know, one of the main writers of the band on bass, was just crazy, you know.
Yeah, super, super talent. And like you said, the three guitar players, when you mentioned he was kind of doing that, you know, energetic thing with the big old Eddie on stage, I think his persona definitely brought that energy, you know, to the stage show and some of the music. I remember seeing, oh gosh, I think it was either Live After Death. Now my brain's slipping. It's late for me. The album that had Tail Gunner as the opening song on it was the first album I think that he was on, and it just was like, wow, they're not losing their edge. They're still bringing it, right? Which I thought was really cool. So you also brought up Van Halen and the changing of singers and the different style of songs that obviously changed too. I have favorites that I like from both of them, from Van Hagar, and a lot of people, you know, they have their opinions. I don't know what side of the fence you sit on.
But I'll let you finish, because Gary Cherone is a fan of both singers, or both all eras of Van Halen. So that was great because he was a fan of the band in both previous incarnations, if you will. And it was great. Like, he could tell he just enjoyed being in that slot, you know, live and stuff, you know. Plus, he had his own success with Extreme. And what a great voice. Wow. You know.
Yeah, his voice is absolutely amazing. I feel actually kind of bad for Gary, because when Diamond Dave left the band, you know, obviously they got Hagar in, right? And that style of music was still prominent in the music scene. And I think that when Gary got into the band, that's kind of when the Seattle scene kind of hit. And not a lot of people listened to Van Halen, you know, at that point, which I thought was kind of...
Is 98's when Cherone, they came out with Van Halen 3.
So if you think about it, they were in the studio at least a year before that, right? So mid-90s.
Yeah. So, I mean the grunge scene was alive and well, but even bands like Pearl Jam were starting to drop off. And I know that Jerry Cantrell was doing solo stuff. I think he had Boogie Depot on some albums like that, and then but after that, he had just released another solo album that came out in like 99, 2000, so he was still out there doing stuff, but and STP, they were doing that whole talk show thing, like, you know, so it was like a lot of changes in members there, and we didn't even have him on the list. I mean, he's changing them same members except the singer. He changed the name of the band, you know, and
yeah,
the Leo Brothers, what a machine! Wow,
yeah, they're locked in tight, man. They know their stuff, what they're doing.
Man, I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan. Wow. Anyway, sorry.
No, you're good. You're good. So, yeah, the Van Halen thing, I mean, the music styles definitely changed. I think Diamond Dave was more kind of an entertainer singer, as where I think Hagar kind of took his stuff a little bit more seriously. And then like you, I was an Extreme fan. I thought Gary's voice was amazing, and he's already worked with, you know, one of what I would consider one of the top-notch guitar players, you know, in the early 90s that came out with Nuno Bettencourt. I mean, that guy was in his own right, you know, doing things that weren't just the typical rock music guitar playing. I mean, Flight of the Bumblebee on Extreme's second album, I mean, I was sold when I heard that. And he just tore that part up.
Their first album was already featured on movie soundtracks. They were huge right out of the gate, you know.
And yeah.
And Nuno Bettencourt is still a monster, and why shouldn't he be? He's still doing what he does best. He was on the Generation X tour. I don't know how many runs of that he did, but he was on there with Malmsteen, Vi, Satch, you know, and it was incredible. And I mean, even the rest of the band that they had backing up was like when they do the big jam. I think Derek Sherinian was on keyboards, and what a powerful lineup. I mean, incredible. And you know, I thought about going and doing that, but I said, you know, I'm kind of done doing the fan thing, and I don't want to sit in line anymore. I want to focus on my own stuff, you know. And it's just, at some point you have to make the decision that you're not going to wait and do these cattle calls, because I'm like, you know, I've been there, done all that. You know what I mean? I'm not going to make this episode about that, but it's just, you know, I decided that, well, instead of just being peripheral, you know, being in the crowd, I'm done, you know, I did my share of those meet and greets and all that stuff. And, you know, at the end of the day, they're tired. They don't want to meet you. They do it for the money. And so why would I participate in that? You know, it was like the whole Eddie Trunk thing. He goes, you know, I hate. He gets pretty worked up. And he's like, you know, I hate to tell you, but they really don't want to meet you. You know, it was like, and I always appreciated his honesty with that. But it was just like, you know. But that was a monstrous tour. I mean, you can see clips. You can see, like, songs that did on that tour. I think it's the last show of a particular run that they did. But Nuno was on that one. They had Tosin Abasi was there. You know, I mean, that must have been an incredible opportunity for him as a, you know, probably the most junior of all those players to be on the tour. Zach Wilde. I mean, wow. You know, incredible. And it kind of motivates you to want to do your own stuff and see how far you can take it, you know, and apply yourself. But that's for a different show. But yeah, as far as other bands that maybe had some lineup changes, I mean, you know, Ozzy is one of the biggest ones.
Huge.
She guitar players. That totally changes the sound.
Drummers, bass players. He's gone through a lot. Yeah.
You name it. I mean, it was like, it's just crazy, because Ozzy was the kind of guy, and still is, that surrounds himself with the best players. And, you know, I mean, you can go online and read about all the conflict that's associated with that type of business model, right? And, but because of that model, we got to hear about these players, and we got exposure to these players, and they got exposures to a worldwide audience. And, you know, I think it was a win-win in a lot of cases. I mean, it put their names on the map, but, you know, there's a lot of great riffs that were written because those different members were in the band. Cause it was like, I think they were leaned on heavily to help write, you know, whether they get credit for it or not, that's another story. And there's a lot of debate about that from the players, but the thing is that you had Jakey Lee, you had Randy Rhodes, you had Brad Gillis for at least one live record. You had, you know, I mean, like Zach Wilde, of course. You had Gus G, who's like freaking sick. Man, the list goes on and on. Bernie Torme joined for a few shows, and then he said that like Randy Rhodes' effects board was haunted because it kept malfunctioning or something like that. And you guys can go online and dig that story up. It's pretty interesting. And so, because they had him use, Brandy was gone, but they needed to fill that spot. And I don't think Brad Gillis was in the fold yet. So Bernie Torme came in, and I think he's a guitarist out of England. And he filled in. He's more of a blues bass guy, I think. But he said, like, using the gear, the pedal board that Randy had, it was like the lights were going all crazy. And you got to remember, I think that was probably a really primitive board that, back in those days, you know, was probably not as refined as they are now. And it's just crazy, but I it's just great to see all these cool riffs that were in such a different style because of these different guitarists. I think when you and I talked earlier, you know, we also talked about that bands that got sober, you know, they already had this illustrious career when they were hip deep in consumption as far as alcoholism and drug use. And one of those bands that they said kind of had a much different sound as a result of that comes to mind is Aerosmith, especially live. I love their studio stuff. And I think that I wasn't there, but it's been said that, you know, after they started getting more sober, some people complain that, well, they're not as wild or whatever. But then other people are like, well, their performances are better because they're not, you know, I guess bogged down with that stuff. But I think a lot of the change and stuff like that has to do with personalities as a result of getting sober, because it'll change you. It's going to make you think differently and function more sharp. So you're like, well, wait a second. I'm not okay with this, because last time this happened, I was three sheets to the wind. So I'm going to have something to say about this. It's just crazy. And especially when, like, you know, Joe Perry went off to go do his own thing, the Joe Perry Project, you know, and Aerosmith they didn't really get another guitarist that I'm aware of. And they kind of split. I don't think they tried to tour, you know, without Steven Tyler that I'm aware of. I could be wrong and someone's probably going crazy, but I don't believe so. I think they kind of stopped touring and, you know, Joe went off and did his own thing for a little while.
Now, even Steven Tyler went, I think he went on, was it American Idol or something like that, as a host or a judge for one season.
This is like in the 80s they had a falling out.
They've had a couple of falling outs.
Yeah, the original ones were in the 80s, because that's when he did the Joe Perry Project. I think he had a couple minor hits, but they weren't nearly, and not that they weren't great tunes, because Joe Perry's an amazing songwriter and guitarist. He's got a bunch of different guitars and pedals and things, and he actually wrote the animated series Spider-Man intro, the theme song. He wrote all of the guitar parts, and he wrote that music for the Fox Spider-Man cartoon series. I was like, he did the voice box, you know, Radioactive Spider-Man. That's Joe Perry. He wrote all that melody. That's all him. He wrote all that stuff. Incredible.
Yeah, some bands, I think, you know, when they're first getting into the mix, they're, you know, they're being handed into this, what a lot of people think would be a glorious entertainment business, right? And as much as I think you can debate it, the news being truth or not, I think what is shown and what's put out there from, you know, the contracts that, you know, during the 80s and the 70s that they put out, they really wanted to make it look glamorous to everybody. But I think there's a dark side to it. And I think a lot of these bands, when they were trying to get signed, at the time when that was huge, what you tried to do is get signed to a label, that dark side kind of came out, right? A lot of these people, you could say, sold their soul, and they get cut up into the drugs and they start producing all these albums, right? And you can go down a long list of different bands that, you know, started out doing drugs. I mean, even Janis Joplin drank on stage. I mean, you could even say it to a point that it created, and it tapped into a creative side of them, and it brought all this music out that everybody enjoyed. But then when they either got healthy or they passed away, because we've lost a lot of great talent along the way, which is, you know, it's sad to me, because there's a lot of people out there that had a lot of amazing talent that we're not going to get back anymore, ever. You won't see the likes of them for at least not in my lifetime. It's that passion that comes out when they wrote those songs that I always kind of gravitated to, right? That when that music changes, and I mean, I've been a Queensryche fan for a long time, and I still like their music. It's just different, right? It's not the way it was when, like, Chris DeGrammo was in the band. Like Warrant, when Janie Lane isn't in the band anymore, it changes the style and it changes what you liked about the music. So, yeah, I mean,
he put so much of himself into that music, and when you don't have that, obviously, like you said, it's going to be a different animal.
Well, it's a package thing now, right? I mean, what a lot of people don't realize, and this is, again, my opinion, when you listen to the songs on the radio, they're prepackaged. They're pushed out by what people think you want to hear, right? there's so much music out there that doesn't get the respect that is due. And there's tons of talent out there that will never see the light of day because of the industry itself, right? YouTube's changed it. You can go out, you can put your own music out there now, Spotify, you know, you can sell your own stuff. So you almost become your own entity in business. You don't go get signed by a label anymore. You put your own stuff out, which is great that there's that outlet now. But at the same time, there's so much of it that it's not going to be mainstream. And to me, the downside of that is, you know, stories like I heard, I'm not going to talk about the band or the name of the song, but they paid $8,000 to get their song played one time at 11 p.m. at night in L.A. on the radio. So they paid this DJ to do it. Guy took the money and played the song, and all of a sudden it's the smash hit, and this band comes up, and all of a sudden now they're famous because of it. And it's like, man.
It's advertising.
It's basically what it comes down to, right? It's whatever they want to push out there that they think you want to hear. It's not the talent that used to be, hey, we have somebody going out and looking for the talent, and we're going to go and seek it and pull it and bring it into the industry anymore. It's different. It's now we're going to force feed you.
Yeah, it's that whole influencer thing, right? And that's what a lot of it is. It's all influence. And it's, yeah, like you said, it's a different animal. There's some cases where you do have an in, you do know some people that have connections and you've networked or something, and it can still work. But that also comes down to, I think, that's where it's really important that as you're writing and creating these things and you have an intent for what you have to say, if people feel it, it's going to gravitate more. And it's going to be more successful than if you just mail it in, you know, and that's not even talking about like how it's getting promoted or whatever. But I think that one, an artist also has to, it's kind of like video games, and you've got people that just like to be play by themselves. And then you've got people that like to play with others. If you're one of those people that likes to play with others, once you start getting noticed, then you're going to be more successful, because if you're with more people, you're getting exposed more. It's kind of like a super group versus a band, or like a tour of all these greats is going to be able to play a bigger festival. They're going to be attract more people than they would on their own. With obviously there are some exceptions to that, but I think even the biggest bands right now from that are considered the greats and the classics still have to tour with other bands that were as significant, and otherwise it doesn't work as well. It still works, but not as well. And you know, I it's like someone like Eddie Trunk will say, like, well, it's about ticket sales and merchandise. He's absolutely right. You make no money off of streaming music or whatever, because everybody just steals it. And as an artist, it's kind of like they're stealing from you, because you put your heart and soul into this and they just take it. But if it's a cool song, that's still exposure, right? Because it gets traded around and other people will hear it somehow. It'll end up on YouTube. I mean, even these guys that try to protect their music through copyright and things of that nature. And this is not a copyright episode, but I'm just saying that there's different ways to get exposure. And I think that if you're someone who plays well with others, which they always say 90% of it's attitude, you know, you could be the best player in the world, but if you can't play well with others, it's no dice. And especially it comes in when you are someone like a guitarist who plays for, say, a guitar slot for like a Nine Inch Nails or a Trent Reznor or someone like that. And they need a player. They need just someone to play the riffs, but not be like a full-time member. It's a hired gun situation. You have to be someone that has an attitude that can play well with others. Otherwise, you won't get the gig. And they could smell you a mile away if you're a dink. And think about it. You have to be on the road touring for months, if not a year or more, with some of the bigger acts. Everyone's going to get a little tired, or there's people that like to tour, but and they love it. They thrive off of it. They get fueled by it. Like, when can we go back out again? But I think you're starting to see a dynamic where there's people that were like, oh, I got to write another record. I have to go tour. And I really don't want to because I just started, you know, that maybe they just had a newborn at the house. They want to spend time with their kids or whatever. It's a different dynamic now, man. It's not like it used to be.
No, not at all.
With all that quote unquote lockdown stuff, I think that really steered people into a different mindset altogether because people had to stop and realize what they had. And I think it's just, it's added a different mind. It's changed things a little bit in people's mentality about how things used to be, you know, even though those are still changing. Like you had to tour and you still do to make money, you know?
Yeah. I think that, for me, what I noticed is in at least what started to be for me in like 98, 99, like you said, you would see these bands start touring with other really well-known bands, right? I mean, you'd always kind of had an opening act that was 15, 20 minutes, right? Get a flavor of a couple songs and then kind of move off the stage. And then you'd have the main band play for an hour and a half. Then you started seeing these bands go and they would get other people that are well-known. They'd start touring with them. Like you said, you saw Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, and Queensryche, right? Each one of them have a little bit longer of a slot time, so the bands are not necessarily playing for an hour and a half anymore on their own. The other thing and big part of it was a shift from what I think the term was arena rock, where you used to have shows, but it used to be arena shows. So when you went to go see a concert, you went to an arena and you sat in there with a lot of people, like a lot. And in the early 2000s, it started shrinking down. You started noticing that bands would start going and doing smaller venues, you know, concert halls or, you know, where they would show plays. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say festivals, right? It was like they'd have Ozfest.
Yep.
And outdoor things. They even tried to do like Woodstock 2, Woodstock 3. You know, and that, of course, the one Woodstock they tried to do was a complete disaster and people were getting ticked off because there wasn't stuff to drink like water and things got torched and set on fire. And I actually had a couple of friends in New York that went to that because the gig was in New York, you know, Woodstock, you know, and they came back and they were shot. They were like dehydrated and one of our buddies passed out on my other buddy's couch. Who didn't go, but like he came in and he's just like, yeah, he said a few words and he passed out on the couch and he didn't get off that couch for the next 4 hours. And then, so when we got to talk to the other guy, he said it was insane. And I think he was kind of like a designated driver kind of guy. So that somebody could drive home. He said it was just madness.
It was tragic. They didn't have enough security. They weren't prepared for it at all. I mean, there was a lot of people that got injured. If you're interested in this topic, I'm not going to go down the road of all the negativity about it. I think there's even a documentary out there now on Netflix, but it just was not good. The changing, right? So they don't do those kind of shows that much anymore. I mean, there are some bands that do. Metallica still, they do their arena shows. Godsmack does arena shows. Tool, they'll do arena shows. But some of these other bands, they'll go to, like I said, theaters, and they'll play at theaters with a little bit smaller of a crowd.
Yeah, my brother took me to see Tool. He wanted someone to go with, so I went with him. And probably the best sound quality, I think, that were as loud as they were playing, my ears did not ring after the show. Their sound quality was dialed in that tight. And they were playing, they had Mr. Bungle open up for them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that group took down their own, put up and took down their own gear. I mean, this was like, it had a very grassroots feel to it, you know, it was from that first band. And so music was a little strange. It really didn't do much for me, but a lot of weird squealing and screeching, but from what I recall. But again, that was 20 years ago. But it was interesting because like the venue wasn't like a big arena like the frickin' Pontiac Silverdome when that was around. This was more like an amphitheater type thing. And I don't remember. The gig was in Portland, or no, it was in Cortland, New York. So it's a college town, New York. And they played one of the, I guess, one of the kind of like smaller arenas there, you know. So it'd be the size of like the Toyota Center here. That's the kind of stuff that these bands in the early 2000s, like late 90s, early 2000s were filling. But you'd have I remember we saw Godsmack like two or three times. And every concert, they just like blew the roof off the place because they played their entire catalog, which up to that point was two albums, but they played every song almost.
And they filled the seats.
What's that?
They could fill the seats.
Yeah, the place was packed because there was a band called that opened up called Systematic, and then it was Cold, and they had that Just Got Wicked song that they came out with, which is a pretty neat tune. And then End of the World was another big hit that they had. And then, so they were the second on the bill. Third on the bill was Stained, and then fourth on the bill was Godsmack. So Godsmack was the headliner. And, I mean, they gave you your money's worth. And when they did, like, Time Bomb was, like, my favorite Godsmack song because it was, like, there's a really cool, I like Tony Rombola's guitar solo on there. It's got a lot of delay and stuff. It just sounds so cool. But then they had this really cool song where, like, Sully Erna would come out and play drums along with their drummer. It was pretty cool. And so they did a little extra. They had some really cool things that were just like a sideshow thing within their own set that I really liked and good memories. And I think I may have told this story before on the show, but we went to one of those shows where all four bands were there. It was at the Pepsi Arena in I think it's Rochester, New York. Mm-hmm. The guy that was going around, I kind of just stayed out of the way of the mosh pits, right? And there was a guy, he was probably, I don't know, 6'8", 6'9", big behemoth of a guy. Just a big, strong guy. And he was high on something. And they dragged this guy. I was out getting nachos or something because I think it was Stained. I wasn't like a big Stained fan, so I went out and used that opportunity to get some refreshments, right? And they had a really nice lobby there, and you could kind of still hear the music and everything piping through the arena. And they were dragging this guy down the stairs of the lobby, and it was probably, it had this deal where there were those stairs that would sprawl out and was really wide, and they'd go down one flight, there was a landing, then they had to drag him down another set of stairs. Because the arena would go up to where the concessionary was, and then you walk down once you got through the other side, similar to like, you know, your typical arena setup, right? This guy's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. He's just screaming. Everyone's like stopping, and they're looking like, oh my gosh, it's the Rochester Mounted Police dragging this guy out. You know, and they had horses and stuff, and so they had to call like this unit to come in and collect this guy. Right. And he was going around punching people. They couldn't see because it was dark. And he's just going around just nailing people in the face, getting violent. And this one guy, some of the guys from my high school were there. One guy got lacerated really bad behind the ear. He had to leave and get stitches because someone had nasty fingernails and he got cut.
Just got cut in the midst of it. Yeah.
It wasn't on purpose. But this other guy, it was I've seen some insane things, Ben. Some of these shows, but aside from that, great music and just like the energy and everything was really cool. And they don't do that stuff now.
Not every band does, no. And I think that's when you're talking about filling out seats and you're filling arenas. I think when you take the entertainment going past what I would consider kind of like being the early 70s, where you would go see the band play, they'd stand there and they'd have their instruments, they'd stand there. Then you have bands like Motley Crue, like Tool, like Godsmack, like Metallica, like Iron Maiden, like what Queensrÿche had done with some of their albums, their concept albums, and you make it a production. You give a performance, but you're also making an entertainment value for what you're getting for paying for the ticket. You are seeing something more than just someone standing there and playing music. And I think that's what brings some of the people back to those shows, is because they know they're going to get something more than just standing there, right? You get to enjoy the music, but now you've got a whole stage production that goes with it. And to me, that's the kind of bands that are going to fill those arenas, and you're going to have more people go to those shows than you will going to the smaller set. Not saying that the smaller sets, the people aren't going to be able to fill those, because they will. I mean, I'll go see bands that I like to hear the music and see them play live. Do I prefer to have either pyrotechnics or some kind of stage show to go with it, or, you know, an awesome background or video settings and stuff that they kind of interact with? It was, to me, it's almost like when CGI became a big thing in movies, right? You got to see movies and you got to see actors do their thing, but now you've got CGI that just brings it to another level, right? So now these bands are bringing that extra level, not only to their music, sonically, but visually as well.
Right, exactly. It just adds to it. And, I mean, one of those other groups that, you know, comes to mind when we talked about, I think, be on the list would be Dokken, however you want to say it. Like, man, I mean, George Lynch, what a monster, you know. And Don Dokken could just write songs right. He could be sitting there and just come up with a melody and a vocal, and everything's just crazy. And, you know, it's just the whole band, like, just phenomenal musicians. And, you know, one of the things with, at least when they lost, when George Lynch went abroad, or went separate ways with the two, Don Dokken and George Lynch didn't get along in their earlier days and stuff. And even when they were like in their 40s, I remember when they had, they came back together and did Shadowlands, but then they didn't last much longer after that. They brought in John Norum, who's frickin' John Norum's a monster player. I mean, oh my gosh, if you're a big fan of like Dorian Mode and all these really hard rock, like blues type, you know, interludes and solos. I mean, I tell you what, I don't even know how to describe this guy. He's what a fantastic vocalist. The total package. He can write great songs. He's just a killer guitarist. He's one of my favorites, man. So it's incredible when you've got these two players that, now he didn't record on any Doc and stuff, but he did fill in some of the tour dates, you know, in the 2000s, right? But even Don Dokken's solo albums are like fantastic, you know, and just, man, these guys are just massive talents, and George Lynch is just killer. I've got this, if you listen, I suggest the album From Inception. Now, this album, this was live recordings from 1981. And it's just incredible. And it's just like the sound of the mobile recording or whatever they use they got that recording clean. Man, you listen to that album, you could get it on iTunes, Apple, or Apple Music or wherever. It's just incredible. I've got it on my phone, and I just play it on the Bluetooth in the car, and it's just incredible to hear it on like a nice surround sound in your car and everything. If you got a smaller car, it's an even bigger effect, and you're feeling that band is like right there, you know. Man, they just did such a great job with that. But man, when you got guys like George Lynch and John Norum in your group, it's just, and a Reb Beach is in Dokken.
Oh, Reb Beach.
I mean, geez Louise.
Forget about it.
With him, they did Erase the Slate, which is a great album. And they had that live album, Live from the Sun, that they did with Reb Beach. I was like, man, they did a version of, I'm trying to remember, what was that song that they did? And Reb Beach did a solo in there, and it was like incredible. It was Too High to Fly. They did a version of that song, and then there's like Reb Beach does this thing with Echo or something, and oh man, I want to go listen to that song after we get done recording this, because I was just like, oh man, it just like takes you to another level, man. It's cosmic how awesome and intense that solo is. And you know, it's just like Jeff Pilson on freaking bass, and oh my gosh, just incredible. They were in the pocket, man, on that tune. And And I feel really bad, though. Like, they've been having some hard times. I know this isn't a docking show, but, like George Lynch, he's, like, fantastic, but, like, he's still awesome. But I feel really bad for Don Dokken, because he's had some medical issues that really weren't his fault. And, like, the poor guy, I mean, his vocals are kind of shot, but he had some things going on, I think he talked about on Eddie Trunk, but I got a tip of the hat to him for just plowing through and giving the fans what they want, you know, and I think it's really awesome what he's doing. And to anyone who would say, well, you know, you don't sound like you used to, you know what, go lick a toilet seat, because you know what, these guys, the show must go on, and I respect anybody that can go out there and still give it to the fans no matter how they feel or what they're going through. That's their heart and that's their passion, and I applaud him for going out there and still delivering a full set.
Heck yeah, he's in it because he loves the music, and the art, the craft of it, right? You can tell that's what he enjoys.
He's an artist. He's a true artist, and you know, if he ever hears this episode, I applaud you, you know, and it's just incredible. It just really, really moved me and showed you what it's really, truly like to be an artist, especially when you have physical things that try to stop you from what you're doing, you know, and it's just great. And I mean, that's the thing. I mean, another group or another artist we didn't mention that has a lot of rotating members every once in a while, Steve Vai. I mean, he's, man, I mean, look at the lineups he's had. Billy Sheehan, Tony McAlpine.
Yeah.
And Elwood, you know, Bolton's like an insane drummer. You know, and you've got Dave Wiener that can do, not only can he be another guitarist, but he can do all these. He's a very multi-talented person. I mean, just, man, what a lineup, you know. And, you know, it's like just crazy. And I'm trying to remember who the, gosh, I am terrible with names this evening, Ben. But I've met a lot of the different, a lot of the different members and things over the years, but is it Brian Beller, that guy, that bass player that he played with the Aristocrats with what's his name, who's it, oh, man, the guitarist, he's freaking insane, he's from England. I am drawing a blank right now. He hit an elm.
I'm not doing good with names tonight either.
Aches. It's just a crazy, crazy stuff, and please forgive me. I'm just drawing a blank tonight, and it was just like crazy. But he was a bass player in that one, and like Brian Beller is nuts. He played with Joe Satriani, and just these monster players, and you know, being able to see the lineup with, like, you know, I got to see. Not only did I get to see Steve Vai with the two violin players, it was back in 07. I got to see him with like Tony McAlpine, and he called that band The Breed, that's what he called them, but it was like Tony McAlpine on keys and guitar, and then it's like they changed up instruments in the middle of the night, in the middle of the set. It was a long set. It was almost like, it was like Bruce Springsteen, you know. It was like I had to sit through the sound check, and like they get, and so, which was pretty intense to watch, because there was, I don't remember what song it was, there was a song they were going to do while, I think he wrote it while they're on tour. And then they were going to perform it, because Steve Vai is known for doing that. And that's how he was able to do Alive in an Ultra World, because he would write songs while they're on the road. And he got to see them rehearse. And Zach, I thought I was going to sneeze there. But anyway, it was like they were going to do a new song. And I don't ever know what it was. But I don't recall anyway, because it was like, man, 2005 or something like that. But there was some rowdy stuff that happened at that show, and we need to have an episode where we talk about like crazy stuff that happens at shows we attended, but it was just,
yeah, we should do that.
What's that?
We should do that for sure.
Next one, that'll be great.
Okay.
And so I kind of got us, it gave us a little taste of that guy getting dragged by his feet out of the Pepsi Arena. But anyway, yeah, it was just like that lineup with those people was freaking nuts. And, like, when you got players of that level, it's just incredible. But the lineup doesn't really, because, like, Steve Vai's the driver, right? So he's got a vision for what he wants. But it's a side benefit to be able to see all these awesome players. You know, even if it's just for, like, a tour or an album, you get to see them change the lineup like that. That's another aspect that's really awesome as a listener. You know?
Yeah, they had, I don't know, you've probably seen this, Taylor Hawkins from the Foo Fighters, the drummer, he passed away. So they've been getting, at least I know of, at least two nights, I believe, if not one night, I could be wrong on that. They have a bunch of different players from different bands that have come out and they've played different songs. And one thing that stood out to me, that being an Eddie Van Halen, huge Eddie Van Halen fan, growing up listening to his stuff, his son Wolf came out and he had stated he was never going to try to rehash or redo what his dad did or play his music. And he came out and he played Hot for Teacher, which I freaking love that song. It's bass, drums, vocal, everything about it is amazing. And then he did Panama, and I watched the videos of him playing, and it, dude, I almost cried. It was awesome. It just absolutely awesome. And I know he probably won't maybe never play that stuff again, and that's fine. He's doing his thing, and he should absolutely continue to do his thing. But to see him come out and play those songs was very moving to me.
I agree, and that was the thing is, I think he did that for people. And you know what? It's kind of like he's looking so much more like his dad every day. And there was a still shot from that show where he did that, and where he's kind of looking straight up, you know? Like he's like looking to the sky while he's playing, and he looks so much like his dad in that shot. And this guy, you know, he nails the parts. I mean, it sounds like his dad's playing them, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, everybody wants to like say, hey, just keep like VH going. Well, guess what? He's doing it with a twist, because not only is he going out and touring on his own with his own group, he called the band Mammoth for crying out loud. That was the original name of like the band way back, you know, Van Halen's Mammoth. And what a huge tribute. And not only that, like his material that he writes on his own and produces and records, does all this instrumentation. He doesn't need to do that. He doesn't need
he's a
player and writer. He doesn't need to like ride anybody's coattails. I mean, I'm sure from a business standpoint, it got him some immediate exposure. Yeah. But from an artistic point of view, he doesn't need that. And he already toured with them for a few years. I mean, with Diamond Dave, and he got to play bass. He's already been in Van Halen. So people need to get off his back about, like, you know, doing Van Halen stuff. He's already done that. He's moving on with his own thing.
Here's the way I look at it. Eddie was just a true pioneer, and we'll never have another Eddie, but he gave us the next best thing. His son is so musically talented, and he handed that down to his son. He's obviously not Eddie, but in his own right, he is an amazing musician. And I think that if people want to, if they want to see Van Halen, go see Mammoth, because you're going to see Van Halen. It's Wolfgang Van Halen.
Well, and that's the thing, though, is like people, I think a lot of people are ignorant and they don't understand the timing and the course of events and the creative things that they actually did as far as, let's see, people. Wolfgang was on a studio album with them. He was also on a live album with them. What more do you want? Okay, and I'm going to rest my case there because, you know, I've always been very supportive of him, on these shows, you know, and it just, what right would he not have where he can go and do whatever he wants to do? You know what I mean?
Well, he should.
Who are these people to say that he they need to get a life?
You know? Well, they need to center themselves and come to grips with the fact that what they knew as Van Halen is done. It's the next generation of student being taught, and now that is being brought forth in his own right, in his own style, in his own way of writing. And I think people need to grab onto that, and I think need to respect it, and they need to enjoy what he brings to the table from everything he's learned from his dad, because that talent is obviously there. You watch him play those songs. Yeah, you watch him play those songs in those videos, and you're damn right. He absolutely nails it. Absolutely nails it. And he wouldn't have been able to do that had he not been taught by the maestro himself, right? I mean, there's just no way.
Well, that was the thing. It's funny. They make a bigger deal out of these last videos than they did when he was actually in Van Halen.
Yeah.
A full-fledged member. They have to do with the fact that it was a Taylor Hawkins audience that was attending this thing. And I think what it did was it was exposed to a different fan base. I think that's got a lot to do with it. Like, oh, wow. You know, people that probably didn't listen to Van Halen because it wasn't their thing. And now he's at a festival to pay tribute. And they're like, oh, wow, this is amazing. What have we missed? And I hope that it takes and puts interest back into their catalog. It's great. And I think it's done that. And yeah.
So I think we're coming up close to the hour here. As always, we want to make sure that we give a shout out to our fellow podcasters and friends, Chuck Lynch, the group at We Hope This Finds You Well, the McSauce Podcast, Fireside Chat. You know, music is, it's there and it's alive. It's kicking. I would recommend anything that we've talked about tonight. Anybody go and check this stuff out, especially the Taylor Hawkins stuff. There's a lot of different bands and a lot of different people that showed up to pay tribute, including Geddy Lee and Alex Lifeson from Rush. So you get really kind of a cool show and a lot of cool stuff in that. But you know, if you're passionate about it, keep it going. Music is universal, and it is soothing the soul for me lately.
Yeah, and one last thing. I was a guest on Tony McAlpine's live stream last week, so you can catch that on, I think, probably Facebook. I was on there, like, last Wednesday night, and so it's also on Facebook. They have it's on YouTube. So I was a guest on there, which I was honored to do so, and got to be on there with some great players. So, that's stuff I've been working with Tony McAlpine for a while now, and it's just been a great experience, and he's pushed me musically, and so I'm working on an EP and everything, so it's inspired me to start creating my own stuff. So you check that out if you're inclined, and I'll try to get a link up on the Twitter podcast page. We will be doing some, like I said earlier in the show, we're going to be maybe putting a few more social media outlets out there. Instagram's been a little difficult because they like to review things for some reason, like I'm some weirdo. So I'm trying to get a more of a formal podcast page for Instagram up. So you'll see that soon. And you know, that those kind of things, we're going to try and get a little bit more multifaceted as far as social media. So stick around for that. Stay tuned. And this was a lot of fun, Ben.
Yeah, always. And hopefully I got some music. Hopefully it'll be out of the hopper here really soon. I know you're working on stuff too. So you stay tuned and we'll put some of our original stuff out, you know, if not for bumper music, but, you know, put it out there for the whole full length of the song than just bits and pieces of it. But hopefully that stuff will be coming out soon, as Justin and I, you know, we have a lot going on in our hopper, and to, you know, write, produce, record, mix and master, it takes a lot longer. But you know, you and I both have the same opinion that if you're going to put something out, put a lot of energy and effort to it, make it the best you can. And then it's never really completed, right? As a famous person once said, you just have to abandon it because you could tinker on it forever. But we'll be hopefully putting out some originals here really soon. All right, we'll catch you guys next time.